As we continue our study from the book of James in chapter 5 and verse 11, where we are now looking at the example of Job, the subject of this middle portion of James 5, the last chapter of the book, has been about the sufferings for righteousness' sake that Christians must endure. We must have long suffering through those things, and we need to have endurance through those things. So we've been instructed to have the long suffering there in verses 7 and 8 particularly, and then endurance in verses 10 and 11. So we have to suffer long and endure through the trials of our faith that will come. And then the Lord has given us so many good examples to encourage us and just give us strength through those sufferings that we have, as we will see others who also had long suffering and endurance through those things. And we're told to take the prophets as examples of suffering, affliction, and of endurance in verse 10. And then in verse 11, he says, "Behold, we count them happy or blessed which endure." And then from there, he says, "You have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy." So there are a couple of particular aspects of the lessons from the book of Job that he is emphasizing here in verse 11 that we're to consider and remember. Verse 11, we started looking into that last week with what happened with Job, because he is one of the great examples in the Bible of endurance of affliction. In fact, when we think of people in the Bible who suffered, doesn't Job come into our minds almost immediately? Perhaps at the top of the list, although of course Jesus would be the one that was that suffered the most, and then the New Testament, the one that followed him, that we're told to follow him as he followed Christ, and we have so many examples of Paul's sufferings. But in the Old Testament, who do we have that is given to us as an example with their detailed sufferings, like Job, who endured all those things? And so we started to look into that in Job chapter 1 last week, and we saw that it was Satan who presented himself before the Lord, and then it was the Lord who brought up Job to Satan, and it was Satan's desire to get to Job, but he could only do what God permitted him to do. And there was a hedge or fence around Job that Satan could not penetrate. Only if God moved it, which he did. He doesn't ever take it away to leave Job completely unprotected in the devil's hands for the devil to freely do everything that he wanted to. And God doesn't do that with any of us. And that's one of the reasons we can learn much from what Job went through, because these things he's describing and how these sufferings come to pass were what happened with Job. It happens with us. Satan, that word means the accuser, and he was accusing Job of only serving God because of how much God blessed him with. And so he said if those things were taken away that God had given to him, then he would curse God. Well, that was a false accusation, but God permitted him to take those things away from Job. But he moved the hedge and did not allow Satan to touch his body. In Job chapter 1, verse 12, the Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and that's when he took all of his children, his 10 children, and all of his possessions, and it comes piecemeal while he receives the news of one tragic event that caused him to lose something. Then another would come with a report of something else that happened. So it was just in succession, one after the other, and letting him know that he lost, he had lost everything. Why did the devil choose to do it in pieces rather than just one thing that took it all, everything away at once? I mean, was he not seeking to achieve maximum pain and suffering to try to destroy Job? And he chose this method to make it to make the temptation greater. But when all of this happened, in verse 20, it says, "Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, 'Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly." So that exposed the lie of Satan's accusation against Job. And then in chapter 2, Satan again presented himself before the Lord. And once again, in verse 2 of chapter 2, the Lord brought Job up to Satan. Or in verses 2 and 3, so verse 3 particularly, and he says, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? And still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause." And Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face." And the Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life." So God moved the hedge again, but he didn't take it away. Satan was not permitted to kill Job. So he did have permission to touch Job physically. And he certainly did that. And he smote him with boils, sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. It said in verse 7. Now, I think probably all of us at one point or another have had a sore, some type of a boil. And any of us that survived our teen years, we went through the pimple stage at one point. We've all had pimples, which are smaller ones, but we've all experienced that. But you get a sore, and I mean that really it's hard to have your mind on something else if you get a really painful sore on you. But to be covered from head to toe, I mean the misery, the physical misery of that would be great. And in verse 8, Job took a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, in verse 9, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." But he said unto her, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? And all this did not Job sin with his lips." So Satan's accusation again was proven false. But this was not just a one-moment situation. And Job is not a two-chapter book or a three-chapter book where after this, then we find what happens at the end. Because James chapter 5, verse 11, not only tells us about the endurance of Job that we need to remember, but also the end of the Lord. And how he was showed pity on Job, So we need to look at what Job did to follow, and also remember what God did with him. All of that is encouraging to us if we will learn the lesson and remember it. But there's a lot between chapter 2 and verse 10 until we get to chapter 42 at the end of the book. What's in between there? Well, the major part of it has to do with what is in verse 11, where it introduces Job's three friends that heard of all that had come upon him. And so Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar came to him for the purpose, it said in verse 11, to comfort him. But what do they end up doing? Yes, they mock him and ridicule him and condemn him, because they misunderstand, and by their misunderstanding, God gives riches to the righteous, and anybody who's poor is wicked. And since Job lost all of his stuff, then that they concluded that meant Job had to be wicked. He had done something awful for God to have done this. So he was deserving of this. They viewed this and said it was punishment for some wicked things that Job had done, which was false. And so Job had to, he was defending himself. So these ones that came to comfort him ended up condemning him and mocking him. And so this became a source of much more temptation for Job in dealing with those ones. Now, they are from, they don't live in the same town that Job is in, but they heard of this and they all came there to be there to comfort Job. Now, that tells us something, this, what Job was smitten with. I mean, how long does this go on? Does he lose all these things and then get boils all over and then endures that and then poof, it's all over right there instantly? No, it didn't happen like that. For these friends that were some distance away to have heard about it and then to journey to be with him, that already tells us this lasted for some length of time. We also have some Job mentioning within the book. We don't have an exact time frame of how long Job was in that physical misery with those boils and with his friends there condemning him. But we know they come to him, and when they're speaking with him, Job refers to this period of time that he's been sick and mentions that it had been months in chapter 7 and verse 3. He says, "So am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me." I mean, when you've been, I think we've all experienced that at least to some degree, where we had some kind of something going on with us physically, and it's hard to sleep. You get much physical misery, and it makes sleep very difficult. Now, Job being covered from head to toe with these sore boils, how would he be able to rest? What position could he get in to be comfortable? If you got boils all over you, I mean, if you try to lie down, I mean, how's that going to feel? And if you try to sit up, how's it going to feel? What do you do? What position do you get in? And how can you get for several hours to be able to get some good rest? I mean, he's describing this. He's been miserable. It went on for months, and the nights were wearisome. He had a very difficult time getting any sleep through this. So he would have been physically miserable, exhausted, and this is going on for months. Also in chapter 29, in verse 2, he says, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me. So there again is another reference to how long this has been going on. So this is something that went on for many months. To give it some perspective, this was not just something that was really bad for a couple of days. I mean, Job was in this state for months. So the temptation, does it disappear or is it there upon him day after day, night after night? And then the friends come and they start condemning him. And then he's got that to deal with. So all of these temptations, or even as we saw in chapter 2, with his own wife telling him to give up his faith and curse God. And how many different temptations was Job dealing with through this long period of time? I mean, there were many of them. And yet, what do we see? Job is steadfast and he endures. So it's to look at a single individual that not for any wickedness that he had done, endured extreme sufferings for righteousness' sake, and then endured through it all and continued to serve his God. I mean, Job is one of the great examples of that. And then we have the end, which is what the Lord tells us to also remember. He says, "You've heard of the patience of Job." Well, we see that there. Yes, we've heard of it. We read about that endurance that he had. And he says, "And have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy." Now, if all we read about was Job having all these things and then he just withered away. And the book also contains some descriptions, mentions of the condition of his skin. He obviously lost weight. I mean, imagine trying to eat. What kind of appetite would you have through all of that? But, there's a lot of description of the physical aspects that come in at various points if we study through that, which are important. That's important information to look at to help us appreciate exactly what he was going through and see what he did endure, but he endured. But if all we saw was this man that had these afflictions and just withered away and then he died, we would have an example there of his endurance, but how encouraging would that be as far as looking at how things are going to end up for us in our sufferings? Might we be thinking, oh great, we're going to suffer and it's all bad and then that's it. Well, that's not the way it is. So we need to see what happens in the end. The Lord did give Satan this period of time, and how many people could have endured months of what Job went through? To have lost everything and then to be in that kind of physical misery and then have those being condemned like he was and to go through that for many months. There are few that have ever lived could have gone through something like this. And there's a reason why God said there was none like him in the earth in his time and why he preserved this example in one of the books of the scriptures, and in the New Testament tells us to hear and remember this. But what happens in the end? What is God's work in this? So God did permit Satan to bring this trial upon Job, but was it within what Job could bear? Great as it was, I mean, what Job could bear was astounding, but was it within what he was able to bear? And it was. And there was an end to it. And when we get to the end of the book of Job, we see what happened after that. And so the Lord did take pity on Job and was of tender mercy. And he restored what he had and blessed him greatly after all of this happened. So in verse 10 of going into the last chapter of the book, chapter 42, verse 10, it says, "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends." Now, that's also interesting, the timing when God decided that was it. Job was instructed, those friends of his that had spoken falsely about the Lord, the Lord told them that they had spoken wrongly, and then said that they were to go to Job. In verse 8, he said, "Therefore, take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that you have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job." And so then those three friends in verse 9 did what God said. But this was the really the final temptation in all of this when it was over with. And here he's been condemned and mocked by these three friends of his. What's the last temptation here? Well, to be bitter and not forgive them. Could he have said, the Lord's going to deal with you after your folly. I'm not praying for you. Remember what all these things you said to me? But that's not what he does. He prays for them. So he's returning good for evil in this towards these three friends who had condemned him. When he prayed for his friends, he says that's when the Lord turned the captivity of Job. And it says also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintance before, and did eat bread with him in his house, and they bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, and 6,000 camels, and 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she asses. He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Kezia, and the name of the third Kurenhappuch. And in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. And after this lived Job 140 years, and saw his sons and his sons' sons even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. That's what happens at the end. And so the Lord does show him great pity and tender mercy, and rewarded him for enduring. Now, the promise the Lord gives us for enduring our afflictions and continuing to do his will, it's not material reward. And we know what, even those things, Job lived 140 more years. I mean, that's a blink of an eye. And then that all those things that he had then were gone. Was that the most important thing that happened, that Job was blessed materially by God? No, and Job didn't serve God for those things, as it was shown. But what was most important, with all that mercy the Lord showed him, and at the end of those days, where's Job now? Does he live? Yes, he lives in a very good place, and he would be in that place called paradise, and where the Lord comforts his servants and the righteous. And one day, of course, he's going to be there on the day of judgment, and he's going to be with his God that he loved and served for all eternity. So the eternal reward is there for him, and will be for us if we also endure. So he reminds us of that. We've got to endure. If we quit, we won't have that. Happy are the ones who endure and Job did. And God shows, gives mercy, tender mercy and pity to those who, of his children, who serve him, and especially through all those afflictions that we must go through in our lives. So that gives us a lot to go with. And when we look at those examples of all the prophets, of Job, and all the other examples that he gives, like we have an entire chapter of in Hebrews 11, and all the other ones the Lord mentions, and the ones in the New Testament, Paul and the others. When we look to those examples that God has given to us of their faith and their obedience to God and their endurance of affliction, does that help us? Does that help us to face what we have to face in our own lives? It does. And we did mention last week also, it's also a good thing that all of our examples and all of our encouragement aren't from ones who are dead already. We get a lot from those examples from the scriptures. They're no longer on the earth. But the Lord does also give us one another to help in this. We should, of course, we're still here right now. And we can be a great encouragement for each other in these things that we go through. And as we do, as one is suffering affliction, then the rest of us can take courage in that, and that should help us through our own afflictions. We see this, just to look at one example of how this works in the book of 1 Thessalonians in chapter 3. This is based on events we read about on Paul's second missionary journey that's recorded in Acts 17. So if you make a note, you can read what happens in Acts 17, and this is what 1 Thessalonians is in reference to. The church at Thessalonica that this epistle was written to was established in Acts 17, the beginning of that chapter, on Paul's second missionary journey, and Silas and Timothy were with him there. And just to mention what happened, summarize that, I mean, they were there, and after 3 weeks of Paul preaching in the synagogue there in Thessalonica, there were some converts among the Jews, but many from the Gentiles, including some very prominent ones of the city, that were converted to Christ. But the Jews who didn't believe stirred up trouble for Paul and the other disciples there. Paul was taken out of the town over to Berea, and then he preached there too. And that's where we read about those noble Berean Jews who were converted. But the unbelieving Jews from Thessalonica then came over to Berea and chased him out of there. And then Paul ended up having to go down to, ended up ultimately in Corinth, but stopped in Athens first. Those are the things we read about in Acts 17. But Jason was one of the converts in Thessalonica, and he and other brethren were dragged before the magistrates of the city. So the persecution that came upon Paul for preaching the gospel in Thessalonica, that came immediately, it also befell the new Christians there. I mean, Paul was not the only one that suffered. In chapter 3 here in 1 Thessalonians, he was writing to them after he had to leave them, and so then this epistle was inspired through him, this letter where he's encouraging them to be steadfast and to endure. And so at the beginning of the chapter, he says, "Wherefore, when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left at Athens alone, and sent Timothy, our brother and minister of God and our fellow laborer in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith, that no man should be moved by these afflictions. For yourselves know that we are appointed thereunto." How do they know that? Because it started happening to them right away. And they've been experiencing that. So Timothy was sent back there so they wouldn't be left alone, and he was sent there expressly to encourage them in enduring their afflictions, to comfort them concerning their faith, and that no man should be moved by these afflictions. That's endurance, to not be moved by those afflictions, to continue to serve the Lord through them. Verse 4, he says, "For verily when we were with you, we told you before that we should suffer tribulation, even as it came to pass, and you know. For this cause, when I could no longer forbear, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter have tempted you and our labor be in vain." I mean, what would have become of Paul's work to convert them if they all quit? So he was concerned about them. Verse 6, he says, "But now when Timothy came from you unto us and brought us good tidings of your faith and charity, and that you have good remembrance of us always, desiring greatly to see us, as we also to see you, therefore, brethren, we were comforted over you all in all our affliction and distress by your faith. For now we live if you stand fast in the Lord." So what was going on with Paul? He was in Athens temporarily and then went on to Corinth. And then he preached there, and he preached. That's where he met Aquila and Priscilla. And then he preached that Jesus is the very Christ, showed them those things. There were converts there. And then what? Who ends up before the deputy of the city there? I mean, who do they try to get in trouble with the officials? I mean, they persecuted Paul. So that happened for Paul in Corinth, and that's where this book is written from. So it was in the middle of that situation. So Paul is himself suffering affliction for preaching the gospel there in Corinth at the very time he's writing this epistle. That's what's going on. Writing it to ones that he had converted shortly before, where he had been driven out of town and persecuted there, and they also were persecuted and were continuing to be persecuted. But when Paul is in his afflictions, what gives him comfort in that, that helps him enduring his own? When he hears about his brethren, those ones in Thessalonica, that were remaining steadfast in the faith, they were not being moved by their afflictions, they continued to grow in faith and in love. And when Timothy reported that to Paul, that was of great comfort to him. So when other children of God suffer affliction and endure it, does that help the rest? That does. That's the way the Lord intends it. So we can do that for each other. As each of us have to face our own trials on our faith, but as we face those things and endure those things, it will encourage the rest of us to do that. And so we can do that mutually and need to do that. That's a very good way that we can encourage one another, because those things are going to happen to us all. So we have all those good examples from the scripture to take, and then the Lord also intends to use us now to help us in that. So the lesson there is, of course, to be long-suffering and to endure. In verse 12, when we turn back to James 5, he says, "But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation." Now, verse 12 begins with an interesting phrase, "But above all things, my brethren." That is not a phrase that we find frequently in the scriptures. It's used very sparingly, as we would probably expect. He doesn't just throw around "above all things" willy-nilly. I mean, it comes up a few times, and we need to look at what that is, because it's when the Lord uses that word or that phrase, It has that meaning. And this one might be a little surprising. If we see that phrase, but above all things, what do we expect to follow from that? We might not be expecting him to say, swear not, to be the commandment that comes above all things. So is the most important thing of all to not swear? If we understand the point and the context of it, then yes, that's going to be way up there for a reason. There's a reason he uses that phrase there. But let's look at the other examples of this that we have in the New Testament. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 14. And none of this is going to be contradictory. We don't want to get the idea, well, if he says above all things and then says teaches something there, and then he says that again another place, that he's teaching something entirely different, and then we might be thinking, well, how can two separate things be above all things? It's not. So Colossians chapter 3, we just have to see how it fits together, which is what understanding is. But Colossians 3 and verse 14 he says, and above all these things, put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. Now, that probably isn't surprising to see that phrase come after above all things, that we put on love, which is the bond of perfectness. So there he's summarizing what is the ultimate purpose of God that we have. That we grow in the image of Christ unto spiritual completion and in what is to be complete in us, but the parts of the love of God. So he's saying that directly there, teaching us to the what is the ultimate end point. And what we're going to see in James 5 verse 12 is going to relate to that. Of course, it's going to be a big part of that as we put that together. So it's not something entirely different. He's just looking at a different aspect of it to give that emphasis to in James 5. But that's what he says there in Colossians 3:14 on that. So there is love and of all the things those that we're to grow in, ultimately, what is the highest? That's it. So that's what we need to put on. And it is the bond of completeness. So that's Colossians 3:14. Well, we have 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. If we can turn there, 1 Peter 4, verse 8. He says, and above all things, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins. Now, is that distinctly different than what we just read in Colossians 3:14? No. Here again, it's about putting on love. But he says, have fervent love among yourselves. Well, how are we going to have the love of God in us if we don't love one another? That is an essential part of that. So here he's giving that emphasis on the love for one another we need to have in order for us to put on love, which is the bond of perfectness. First Peter 4 and verse 8 fits very well with what we just read in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 14. We have close to that phrase in Ephesians 6 and verse 16 when he's describing the whole armor of God, and then he says, above all, taking the shield of faith, and tells us what that shield of faith is able to do. In the context there, he's pointing out that part of the armor above all the other parts of the armor to put on, to take that shield of faith. So that's a little bit different than when he says above all things in Colossians 3:14 and 1 Peter 4:8. A little bit different with the context being where it is relating particularly to the parts of the armor of God. So it's not as above all things, but it is above all the other parts of the armor of God. So the phrasing is a little bit different too, as we see that. That's it. And the closest other passage we have to this is 3 John 2, when he says, "Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth." But as far as God instructing us and saying above all things, we really have the three places, Colossians 3:14, 1 Peter 4:8, and then here in James 5:12. And we saw with those first two, Colossians 3:14 and 1 Peter 4:8, that they're very closely related. But when we really look into it, James 5:12 is also... is the above all things, is it swear not, period? So that we end up concluding that the most important commandment in all the Bible is to not swear. No, that's not... there's not a period after that. There's a reason why he says, there's a reason why he teaches us not to swear. And this is something we're going to have to go digging into to understand that better. So we'll have to look at some other passages on this subject. But for the time being, just within verse 12, he says, "But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but..." See, this is all part of this, above all things. Why not swear? What should we do? He says, "But let your yea be yea," that's your yes, "be yes, and your no, no, lest you fall into condemnation." So the point in the context here of why not to swear is that's going to lead us into condemnation by using words and saying things that we shouldn't. The real point there is for us to do what with our tongues? Something we've already seen extensively in the book of James. If we can have our yes to be yes and our no, no, and keep our tongues from getting us to fall into condemnation, what are we doing with our tongues? We're bridling them. So he's really going back to that, but giving an example here, another specific example of a way that our tongues can lead us into condemnation. But the point is to bridle our tongues so that what we're saying, the words that we're choosing, are good and right words, that where we're not going to get ourselves in trouble. And that's what chapter 3 was all about. But what did we also see at the beginning of chapter 3 in the bridling of our tongues? When we're able to bridle our tongues, what are we also able to do? Bridle the whole body. So which part of our body, which member is the hardest one to get under control? Our tongues. That's the point that teaches there. So in James chapter 3 and verse 2, he says, "For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body." Now he's using words that we saw in Colossians 3:14 and 1 Peter 4 verse 8, isn't he? Does this tie back into that purpose that God has for us to put on love, which is the bond of perfectness, that we would be complete in all the parts of his love? Yes. When we grow in the image of Christ to the point where we can bridle our tongues, then he says that's where we are spiritually at that point. So that is... he is encouraging us to that same point with that teaching in James 5, verse 12. But he's approaching it from the point of looking at our tongues. And then, yes, there is some specific instruction regarding swearing that we can look at there, because that is something that would get us into trouble, and it gets a lot of people into trouble. How many people swear? Yeah, that's right. That is the better question, is who doesn't? And people, and my wife points this out a lot too, when any when anybody leaves off something where they're swearing that what they're saying is the truth, you can guarantee they're lying almost 100%. I mean, that's just about anybody that's trying to convince you of what they're saying, where they're having to swear by whatever it is that comes out of their mouth. I mean, they're almost invariably they're lying, which says that what their very oath that they're swearing is falsehood. I mean, that happens constantly. So people would, but it's also a phrase that people will swear by, and they'll say they swear, and how many people are even thinking about what they're saying, and what words come out then? And there's a reason and that God says this, because this can get us just, if our tongues are going without our thinking about what we're saying, and this is something we also saw back in James chapter 1 and verse 19, isn't it? Be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath, slow to anger. And how much trouble would we save ourselves from if we did that always, if we were very quick to hear, to listen, and we were very slow to say something, to speak, and slow to getting angry? I mean, how much of the battle can we win just with that? A lot. Well, this goes with it too. People throwing words out, they're not even thinking about what they're saying, and then they're swearing all kinds of things. Do those words matter to God? They do. So let's look at this a little bit more. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but we'll look at what we can in the remaining time that we have, Lord willing. So if we were to go back to the Old Testament, because if we're going to search what the Bible teaches or says about swearing, there's a lot of that in the Old Testament. So if we were going to look at the Old Testament law and find the commandment where God commanded the people to swear an oath, where's that reference? We're not going to find where God was commanding them to swear an oath. He does give commandments that if they did that, here's what the law is. In a similar fashion, in the New Testament, we could compare this perhaps to fasting. Where in the New Testament are we commanded to fast? And that is to deprive ourselves of food or something for some period of time for our religious observance, where we are in that respect afflicting ourselves. We're not commanded to do that in the New Testament. Now, if somebody does engage in that, we have Jesus gave instructions in Matthew chapter 6, things to do and not do. So that would apply there. So he said in Matthew 6, verse 16, "Moreover, when you fast, be not as the hypocrites are." And then he says what not to do and what to do. But he doesn't command that we do that. Well, it's similar to that in the Old Testament law. He didn't command them. It was a common practice, just like fasting was and is for some today. But part of what Jesus commands about fasting, we shouldn't really know how common it is today, should we? How would we know it's common if we talked about doing it? But what's one of the rules that Jesus gives if we're fasting? Don't tell anybody. So if we ever did, should anybody know about it? It's supposed to be between us and God. And why would people tell somebody else they're fasting? To get the glory of men. Because to impress other people and to have them to think they're really very spiritual and righteous to be doing that. And so people do that to get, and that's what the, when he said not as the Pharisees, and they were hypocrites, that's what they were doing. They would fast and disfigure their faces, really look like they were suffering, and make everybody see that, know that, so that everybody would give them their glory and praise them about how righteous and holy they were. And I know I've mentioned to you before the one that still astounds me to this day, even though it was more than 20 years ago, the one of our brethren in Christ that sent flyers all over the city over there in Chennai, India, where we were, and they announcing that they were, and trying to encourage all the other brethren in the city to do the same thing, to engage in a fast, and it was going to be for 40 days. Every day between 9 in the morning and noon. It's a real sacrifice. Most of us, I know it can be hard for some people, but most of us can manage to survive without food between breakfast and lunch, which were the exact hours of that 40-day fasting. It was dripping with hypocrisy. I mean, can I get on your hands when you pick up the flyer? But anyway, it was so hypocritical just to look at that and a violation of what Jesus taught. And then why are you sending that around to the city to everybody to tell them what you're doing? If that's what you want, if that's what you decided to do, that you're going to, for 40 days, you're going to not eat between breakfast and lunch. Who should know about that? Nobody. So kind of a soft topic there, but anyway, New Testament doesn't command fasting. There are instructions if you do it. Here's what they are. Well, the Old Testament didn't command swearing. It was a common practice, though, and the Lord gave a commandment about it in Numbers chapter 30. So this would, as far as oaths and vows, those aren't commanded, but this is the principle that the Lord goes by and why he made this the law. Numbers 30, verses 1 and 2, says, "And Moses spake unto the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, This is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth." So if they swore they were going to do something, and really what's the practical difference between swearing an oath and making a vow? I mean, there's a reason he mentions that together. If there's really any difference, it's going to be difficult to discern what that difference would be, but there's one rule here from the Lord about that. Somebody who swore or vowed, what was the rule? You better do what you say. So he didn't command that they do that, but he did command that if they did it, they better keep what they uttered. So if they swore to do something, they were obligated by God to do that. What if somebody swore that they were going to do something, swore an oath, and then realized shortly thereafter that, I don't think I should have said that. Now I put myself under an obligation. I really can't. That's going to be very difficult to fulfill that. I messed up. I made a mistake. Cancel that. Could you do that? Could you just verbally void whatever you just swore or vowed that you were going to do and then be released by God from that? No. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, the Lord addressed that there. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 1 through 6 says, "Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few." Now, as far as the basic instruction there in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 2, how much does it differ from the point that's being made in James 5:12? It's the same. God's in heaven, we're here on earth, and we need to be very sparing with our words, because if we are rash with our mouth, are we going to get ourselves in trouble? We will. Verse 3 says, "For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands?" And that's what God thinks of ones who swear oaths and make vows and don't keep them. He regards them as fools. And we don't want God to be angry with our voice and then destroy the works of our hands. But that's what he's describing as how he would respond to the ones who would do that and then not fulfill what they said. Now, one of the things that one of the characteristics that God mentioned in Psalm 15, when he in that very short psalm there, is describing the characteristics, the heart of those that are going to be with God in heaven in eternity, who would abide in his tabernacle and dwell in his holy hill, as he is begins the psalm with the question, verse 1. Well, one of the characteristics in verse 4, he says, "In whose eyes a vile person is contemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not." So someone who is, he's describing faithfulness and that that quality that we have to have. Somebody that is so faithful that if they have, if they were under some kind of oath or vow, that they would keep that. And they would be faithful to it to the point, no matter how much it hurt them to do it. Well, that is showing faithfulness, the degree of faithfulness that would be in a person. And that kind of faithfulness is one of those great characteristics that God desires that we have. I mean, he has it, and we're supposed to have it as he does. So there's a reason why he points that out there like that. We want to look at some more on that subject next week, the Lord willing. We are out of time, but we have some other passages that would be helpful to us to read. Because in the New Testament, even though swearing of oaths was permitted under the Old Testament, it was with the commandment that they had to follow through and keep whatever they said. In the New Testament, in the law of Christ, he plainly tells us not to do it at all. We just saw that in James 5:12. That's not the only place either, but Jesus, especially in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, also says the same. So we want to look at that, Lord willing, next Wednesday night in our study together, if the Lord wills.